Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm optometrist Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry. This is the podcast from Docket, part of our high-quality continuing education and training programme for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. With case studies and in-depth conversations, these podcasts explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. This month, we're looking at medical retina. As optometrists, we want all our patients to see 6/6 vision, or better. But sometimes that's impossible, and the problem is often at the back of the eye. Conditions of the retina can be genetic or acquired, but even with advanced diagnostic imaging, it can be challenging for optometrists to decide when people need to be referred. Shortly, I'll be talking to consultant ophthalmologist and specialist in medical retina, Rupal Mojaria. Before that, our producer Richard Hollingham has been talking to Brian, a former naval aviator, so used to having near-perfect vision. He's now in his early 80s and was diagnosed with wet AMD 8 years ago.
I'd been going to the same optometrist for about 4 or 5 years, and I had just bought a new and fairly expensive pair of spectacles. Suddenly they didn't seem to be working nearly as well, and so I went back. Said to him, look, I think maybe the prescription is wrong. He had a look at my eyes and said, don't think it is. I think what you should do is go to Western Eye Hospital now, please. So I did.
So he thought there was something quite badly wrong that needed urgent attention. What happened when you got to the hospital?
When I actually got to see the doctor, he was busily trying to treat, I think, 2 or 3 patients at the same time. So it was a fairly busy place, to put it mildly.
Did they do a scan, or what sort of investigation did you get?
Well, it was literally just drops in my eyes, and then a chap looking in through one of these machines that gives you the opportunity to look at the back of the eye. And the doctor, who, as I say, was very busy, simply fairly quickly came to the conclusion that it looks like macular degeneration. I don't know if it's wet or dry. I will put you down on our list to get an appointment. It'll take about 6 weeks.
And how did that leave you feeling? Because for most people, they wouldn't necessarily know what wet or dry macular degeneration are.
I left, I have to say, somewhat perplexed. I came home, got onto the internet and dialed in macular degeneration. Amongst other things, up popped up the Macular Society. But then decided that perhaps the best thing to do would be to dial their helpline. They said, well, hang on, did they not tell you whether it's wet or dry? So I said, no, that wasn't clear. Well, if it's wet, you need to be seen this week.
You ended up having this treatment for wet AMD on the NHS. What was that first treatment like when you go in expecting and knowing you're going to have an injection into your eye?
The very first time, I have to say, I was terrified. I wasn't actually sort of shaking in my shoes, but I was certainly extremely anxious. I was shown into the treatment room and asked to lay on a couch. The most unpleasant part of it, with hindsight, although it wasn't at the time, was that they then put a clamp on my eyelids to hold my eye open. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to see this damn great big syringe coming at me. And yeah, I was concerned. But in fact, I had no cause to be, because at an appropriate moment, the doctor said, look, I'm going to ask you to look over to your left, and then I'm going to make a small mark on your eyeball, which is where the injection will go in, but I want to mark it clearly first. You'll feel a little pressure. Okay, so I look to the left, and fair enough, I get a little pressure. And then he said, okay, was that all right? yes, that's fine. Okay, well, you can get up now. We've done the injection, which I thought was wonderful. And it was so easy and so painless, and faced the rest of the injections later. In total, I think I had about a dozen, maybe 14, with a much easier mind.
And what's your eyesight like now?
My eyesight is getting gradually worse. Unable to see faces clearly. They're sort of pale blobs. And, of course, I can't read at all unless the print is about 30 to 40 point. It's really very large indeed, and that's where I get by on my computer, is by enlarging the screen tremendously. Most of the films that describe macular degeneration show a view of the world with a black blob in the middle. I don't have that. What I have is a sort of a fuzzy area in the middle. Sometimes the brain fills in the gap, as it were.
That's Brian Naylor, who now campaigns for the Macular Society. And thanks very much to them for their help with this podcast. Let's pick up on some of those points with Rupal Mordaria, consultant ophthalmologist at the Sandwell and West Birmingham Hospitals NHS Trust. Rupal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invite.
So Brian told us about his experience 8 years ago now, which wasn't that great. But pathways are much more streamlined now, aren't they?
Yes, they are, very much so. So we have a two-week wait. So either the GP or the optometrist can directly refer patients. If it's identified quickly, they would directly go in, have their visions, their OCT scan. And if they are diagnosed with wet macular degeneration on the day of the appointment, they would get an injection either on the day or within 2 weeks, which is a much more efficient system, allowing rapid diagnosis and treatment.
Mm. So OCT has really changed the way AMD can be diagnosed. But OCT is a very different way of looking at the retina, isn't it? So for me, I think about fundoscopy as a little bit like looking at a map where you can see the rivers, the rows and the landmark features. Whereas OCT gives you more of a cross section through the map. So as well as seeing the layers of the earth, you can actually determine what makes up those landmark features. So for example, if you were looking at a mountain, you can see whether it's solid rock, or you could see if it was hollow inside, like had something inside like a volcano. And OCT is very much like that, isn't it?
I really like your description, actually, Michelle. I've never thought of it that way. I think of the two going together, a retinal exam and an OCT. And it's really important because, for example, I do a lot of virtual clinics now, especially with COVID. Sometimes if I haven't got good retinal images, I do feel almost lost, because if you're looking at the retina and you see something that looks like fluid or greyish area, you think that could probably be wet macular degeneration, but the OCT just really confirms it. And it could be something else. And likewise, when I look at an OCT, I can be suspicious of a pathology, but it's really helpful for me to look at the retina to know whether it's related to diabetic retinopathy or vein occlusion. So I think the two systems work really well together, having the ability to be able to examine the fundus and have an OCT to make a diagnosis.
So it's about getting the whole picture, isn't it, really? It's having the two things together and putting the two together to give you that whole picture.
Yes, and it's also meant that we don't have to wait weeks and weeks for a fluorescein angiogram, because when anti-VEGF first came out, all units used to do a fluorescein angiogram before they could treat the patient, which meant there were such long waiting lists for the fluorescein angiogram. Now, having got an OCT, we can get a diagnosis straight away. We can move on to the injections rather than waiting a much longer period. And some people aren't even able to have an FFA.
So just thinking about going back to OCT, it's quite a new technology for a lot of optometrists, and we're not very familiar with interpreting it. So when you look at an OCT, how do you go about interpreting it? How do you break it down?
Like we do with the eye, when you're examining the eye, you go from the outside to the inside. You move from the lids, look at the lashes, look at the conjunctiva, and there is a system. Whichever system the different clinician uses, they have a system to make sure they don't miss anything. I like to start from the vitreous interface and look at the vitreous and see if there's any pull in the retina, look at, for an epiretinal membrane, look at the outer nerve layer, and then move in slowly. And as I move in slowly, I will be able to assess for each pathology. You know, is there any nerve fiber layer thinning? Is there any fluid in the middle layers of the retina? Is there any fluid in the subretinal layers? Is there any damage to the photoreceptors? And by moving from outside to in or inside to out, whichever system people prefer, you just go through each layer one by one and check that There's no distortion, there's no fluid, there's no mass, or, you know, like you explained, empty spaces that you need to look further into.
I guess it's sort of shifting the emphasis a little bit of what we're looking at, isn't it, to make sure we get the right information from the OCT.
Yes, like I agree with you. So when you look at an OCT, obviously the foveal shape is completely distorted, then your attention will be drawn to it. But it's important not just to concentrate on the fovea and see why that's happening. Is it because there's vitreomacular traction, which is pulling at the fovea? Is it because there's diabetic maculopathy in the cysts, which is pushing the fovea up? So I tend to look less on the fovea, but more the surrounding structures to see why there's an effect and what's causing it.
So Rupal, when we've looked at that OCT image and we've looked at the different layers and we're trying to decide what's normal and what's abnormal, with AMD, are there any particular changes that we need to look out for?
Okay, so you look at the retina. Firstly, on clinical examination, you look at drusen, any signs of atrophy, any bleeding. You correlate your retinal examination with these findings on the OCT scan. So I would look for drusen, and if there's any drusen, I would see if there's any rupture into the Bruch's membrane and any associated fluid. If there's associated fluid, that turns my suspicion straight into wet macular degeneration. I would look for subretinal fluid, intraretinal fluid, pigment epithelial detachments. If they are just drusen, then I normally try and quantify them. So are they small? Are they fine? Reticular? Are they medium-sized or large? Multiple large drusen, again, increase the risk of the patient. And I look for symmetry in both eyes.
So with OCT, I mean, even just from talking to me, that you can obviously tell there's a limit to how much training experience optometrists get with OCT interpretation. Quite often, we don't always see a lot of pathology as well. So when we see something on OCT that we're not sure about, when do we refer?
I think it's always best to be safer. I think if a patient has got rapidly changing vision, new changes, a hemorrhage, family history of sight loss, these are all good criteria for referring. You know, sometimes we just say, they say query wet AMD, see in 2 weeks. However, you can imagine the number of referrals a hospital gets to say see in 2 weeks. We have to triage all the referrals. So if I get a referral that say drusen, query wet AMD, see in 2 weeks, or I have a referral that says vision gone down from 6.6 to 6.36, I can't see any hemorrhage, but family history of wet macular degeneration, see in 2 weeks, I'm going to choose a second one.
So from a triage point of view, what essential things do you want to see on a referral letter? What are the really critical points that you need to have on there in order to make that decision as to whether you see that patient in 2 weeks as requested or whether you might have to delay them to maybe 4 or 6 weeks?
I think as much information we can have, the better. If they've seen the patient before, they have a vision before and after, that's very useful. If you've got OCT, nowadays I have had referrals with the OCT attached, which is again really useful. If there's a hemorrhage or not, if there's an exudation, if they can see a PED. Family history is also useful for many reasons. And if the patient self-referred or if it was a routine check, that's also important, because if the patient self-referred, they've obviously noticed the vision change. And it's likely to be something new that needs to be treated and seen to.
Yes, because when a patient notices themselves, it tends to be a little bit more drastic, doesn't it? So
yes.
It tends to be more and more sudden. So I guess with older patients as well, there are other factors that could come into play with their referral. So, for example, if they've got any other pathology.
The thing with retinal patients is a lot of them are elderly, like you said, and there are mixed pathology. And so understandably, sometimes the optometrist might say query cataract, query wet AMD, which again we do prioritize because it can be very difficult to visualize the fundus and even get clear OCT images when there is a dense cataract. The other thing that's important is drug history, because like the elderly will be on lots of treatments, they might have lots of medical problems, so they might be hypertensive, have high cholesterol, have diabetes, and I see that they've got all these conditions, they're higher risk of getting things like vein occlusions or artery occlusions, which could have caused the loss of vision. Equally, if there's a young patient presented with loss of vision, we don't know why, and you take a drug history and they're known to have asthma and be on steroid inhalers, then immediately I've got a differential diagnosis of central serous retinopathy. Ophthalmology is one of those subjects that we get a lot out just from speaking to the patient.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Henretti. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. We'd love to hear from you with any suggestions for subjects or questions that you might have about any of the areas that we've covered. You can email us at podcast@docket.info or tweet at Sound Optometry. This month, we're looking at medical retina with my guest, consultant ophthalmologist Rupam Wajaria. Let's come on to treatment. We heard earlier about Brian's experiences. He has wet AMD. What does treatment normally involve?
So treatments for wet macular degeneration involve an injection into the back of the eye. Currently, we use a drug called Lucentis or Eylea, but the government has been looking into giving Avastin as well, which has been approved. These injections block the VEGF drive, so they initially are monthly injections, and then we try and treat and extend. So we try and extend the treatment from 4 weeks to 6, 8, 12 weeks, whatever the patient tolerates, without visual decline or without a resurgence of the fluid.
That's obviously better for the patient because ultimately it means hopefully less injections in the long run, and there's less footfall into the hospital at the moment, which is really important during the current pandemic, isn't it?
Exactly. And this has been really helpful because during the pandemic, we've actually tried to extend our patients even more. And some that have always stayed at 12 weeks, we've managed to push to 16 weeks. And we found they've had no visual decline or return in subretinal fluid. They're actually developing new drugs now to see if they can even last longer in the eye by the molecule being slightly different and being smaller. So I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more treatments out there for wet macular degeneration.
So that would be fantastic if that does actually work out really well, because at the moment, departments are very much overwhelmed with the number of patients that need to come for these regular injections. So extending the period would be great. How do patients react to the idea of injections? Because it sounds quite scary, doesn't it, having to have an injection in your eye?
Yes, I do get some patients who are very frightened when they first come. And I find there's a number of things that help them. So those patients who've had quite a lot of information from their optometrist or the GP beforehand seem to be better prepared. Also patients who know a friend or a relative who's had the treatment, they deal with the diagnosis much better and they're much better coming for the treatment. I like to explain it as having a blood test. As you may know, you might know people who faint having a blood test or people who just don't even feel it. It's like a small prick and it's done. So once I explain the process to them, they're more at ease. Once you explain, the eye's numb and the needle actually goes to the side of the eye, to the white area of the eye, and they don't see the needle coming towards their eye. They feel a lot more at ease. So just explaining the procedure, why we do it, you know, to prevent their sight loss and what type of results we see, really puts them at ease.
Quite a lot of patients have dry AMD, and currently we tell those patients that there is no treatment for them at the moment. But is that about to change?
So again, dry AMD has actually been an area of interest for many scientists for years. They're looking at treatments from drop treatments to intravitreal injection treatments involving gene therapy to see if these can help with dry AMD. We have to tell patients there's no treatment at the moment, but there are lots of treatments in production from phase 1 trials to phase 4 trials for dry AMD.
So if there are phase 4 trials going through and if they are successful, how soon would that translate to a treatment that can be offered to patients?
It's very difficult to know. So sometimes look at the COVID vaccine. It's come through very quickly this year. It all depends on what we find from these phase 3 and 4 trials, how quickly they get FDA and NICE approvals. It all depends on the risk profiles and the effectiveness of the treatment and the results at the end. So it's very difficult to know how quickly these treatments will come.
It's nice to be able to say to patients that it might happen within the next few years, but actually we can't promise them that, can we?
No, we can't. Although I remember while I was doing my PhD, my colleagues looking at gene therapy in mice. And, you know, this year we've had Luxturna approved as gene therapy for retinitis pigmentosa patients. And this has all been over a 10-year period. So sometimes things can move really quickly.
Yes, yeah, so other aspects of medical retinal conditions are the genetic conditions such as retinitis pigmentosa. So you've mentioned the gene therapy. up till now, there's been no treatment for retinitis pigmentosa, has there?
No. So retinitis pigmentosa is an umbrella term. It's a hereditary retinal condition, and it's often passed on from the family, or it can be a new mutation causing the symptoms. We can't treat all patients with retinitis pigmentosa. The current treatment, it depends on the mutation they've got. So it's a gene therapy that's applied, and it's actually a viral vector. They've looked at the RPE65 mutation, taken out the defective gene, inserted the correct gene into this virus, and then the way it's applied is they make a little bubble under the retina, inject the virus to try and help some of the retina regenerate. So they are looking at other gene therapies for other conditions, but all these different gene therapy conditions look at the specific genetic defect.
So Rupal, this is really exciting, because I've never thought that I'd be able to say to a patient that their retinitis pigmentosa could be treated. Who can be treated? So at what point do they need to be referred? Is it someone who is still quite young in the early stages of their disease, or can someone who has a more advanced condition still be treated?
So it's really interesting you say this, because people don't know who to refer to retinal geneticist and when to refer. So what I say to my colleagues is, if you've got a young patient who you suspect have retinitis pigmentosa that you think might want to start a family, please refer them along to me, because firstly, I would like to look at their condition to try and identify phenotypically what it looks like. And then these patients would benefit from genetic testing. If we find what the genetic error is and whether it's recessive or dominant, it could have an impact on them starting a family. The second thing is, you asked particularly for treatment. It's not depending on age. So current treatments, the earlier treatments were done on patients with very poor vision, and they found very good results with the gene therapy. So the reason we looked at patients with poor vision was we looked at patients with bilateral symmetrical vision. They put the gene therapy in so the other eye could be compared at. And it's because the surgery itself is quite a large surgery. It involves going to the back of the eye and going under the retina. So the procedure itself can cause some loss of vision. So we've initially only been doing the patients with very poor vision.
So are these treatments available via the normal NHS route? Can we refer patients into the NHS as normal if we suspect someone has retinitis pigmentosa, or if we know someone who has already had the condition diagnosed perhaps a few years ago and is now interested in finding out if they are suitable for any therapy?
So there are specialist centres in the country that are doing retinal gene therapy. I work in Birmingham, and I have a specialist retinal genetics clinic. So all the patients in the neighbouring units, they get referred to me where I see them. If I think the patient's suitable for any trials or gene therapy, then I then refer them along to the centre that they would be best suited to, because not all patients are suitable for gene therapy, and some patients just need to be seen, counselled. With all treatments, not everyone will even want the treatment if they aren't suitable, so we need to do the preliminary checks first.
So Rupal, that leads me on to something else I wanted to ask you about as well. For those patients who don't want to be referred into the NHS, or perhaps have already been referred and are not suitable for any treatment or therapy, what else can we do to help them?
Yeah, that's really interesting you say that, because at the moment I've been saying to my colleagues, please feel free to refer patients to me even if they've been seen 10 years ago, because things are changing. And even if the patients aren't suitable for treatment or they don't want any treatment, there are things we can do that can really help them. Firstly, there's lots of patients out there who haven't been registered sight impaired. Being registered sight impaired can really help patients by providing them more support. For example, I had a patient who said, "Thank you for getting me registered, because now I have a white stick. Not only do I feel more confident going out to the shops alone, but people don't get annoyed at me for bumping into them. They actually turn around, see I've got a white stick, and stop to try and help me."
Is there anything else that optometrists can recommend to their patients, such as specialist lenses or filters perhaps?
The problem with retinitis pigmentosa is you get increased photoreceptor death with UV light. So one of the things I advise them is to protect their eyes against UV damage. which includes wearing a cap, so it takes away that top light, and the filters on the lenses will help them stop feeling light sensitive and also takes away some of the glare they feel. So these patients can't wear photochromic lenses, depending on how dark the tint goes, because if it's a very dark tint, they have a very poor dark adaptation. So they benefit from some sort of mild tint. And normally, having spoken to patients over the years, they find a yellow filter, for example, it helps relieve their symptoms of the glare they see and also protects their eyes.
Rupa Mojare, thank you very much for joining me. If there was one key message that you had for optometrists out there listening, what would that be?
I would say just put as much down on the referral as you feel. Don't ever feel that we're too busy and we won't read the referral. We read all the referrals. The more information there are, the easier it is for us to triage the patients. Also, for me personally, I do like to give feedback, and I do know from the community they often feel they don't hear back. But sometimes we might have a stamp or we might not be able to read the referring optometrist's name. But I think the key message is, if in doubt, refer.
Thanks, Rupal. I think we always used to joke that doctors' handwriting was terrible, but I can tell you optometrists' handwriting can be just as bad. If you would like more information about dealing with the aspects of medical retina covered in this episode, visit our website, docit.info, and search for sound optometry to find the resources and the reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise will gain you one CET point. We'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about sound optometry. Maybe suggest that your colleagues listen or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.